Start of interview with N.W. Atukorala, 27th of April, 1967.
Oh, sir. Good.
I was wondering whether we could take off from where we left off yesterday, because I can remember thinking of several things following your account. For instance, Caldicott's place. It would appear that he, to some extent at least, he had to act as a buffer between Leighton and the minister.
Well, quite frankly, he not only had a most difficult task in acting as buffer between the two, but I'm not so sure that Leighton did treat him with that respect and command that a governor of a country should receive, you see, partly perhaps due to the fact that Leighton was a man with a military background and was not so very worried about these finenesses in civil administration, you see. Well, that may be one of the reasons. But of course, the main reason was that he did want to get a job of work done, you see, and he had to do it by hook or by crook. And thirdly, of course, he was himself shrewd enough to realize that through the governor and the leaders of the country, there was quite a lot of work that they could do, you see. So there you are. That's the position as far as I can see. And certainly I do think that you're quite right in saying that Leighton had Caldicott had a really difficult time trying to get things organized and getting his ministers to cooperate fully with the commander-in-chief, who positioned vis-a-vis Caldicott as governor was also a little, you know, uncertain at the time, till it was, I believe, made quite clear by an announcement made by the Secretary of State or something like that.
How did D.S., for instance, get on with Caldicott?
Well, as I told you, you see, he was the one man who at the initial stages showed Leighton exactly where he stood in this country. He made it quite clear to him that he was sent here to defend the country, which was going to be the last bastion of the East, as it were, as far as communism or any other form of government was concerned, and that he or anyone else, for any foreigner whom he got down, would just be perfectly helpless without the assistance of the population of the country, you see, which they had to obtain through the duly constituted leaders of the people, you see, that is the duly, that the ministers of the cabinet, of the board of ministers, they were called at the time.
I mean, how would you assess Caldicott? Was he liberal or did he tend to be authoritarian?
Well, I will tell you, Caldicott was himself, as you know, one of these civil servants who served in colonies for a long time, starting as a cadet and working his way up to be chief secretary of some federated Malay states or something like that, and eventually ending up as governor of Ceylon. He was, to my own mind, a brilliant man, and a man whose minutes I always loved reading, you see, for the simple reason that they were very well styled, and I do remember at that time, there were a lot of cables that used to pass through the chief secretary's office and through his office that sent all the cables. Now, of course, in this independent state, of course, it's the Ministry of Defense and External Affairs that deals with all the cables and the telex messages and whatnot. I do remember a very good example of a long message dealing with some food matter, where he amended it in such a way that, you see, he conveyed practically the same meaning in 50% of the words that were used, and put down below that, "Honorable Minister, blue penciling drafts of letters or telegrams sent to a governor is no part of a governor's job." We have seen a minute he made. He was a brilliant man. And he was also a man who was able, I think, to get on with people, although he certainly did have rubs with our ministers in the early stages. But during the period of the war, I think he proved an asset, as you say, as a buffer, particularly as a buffer between Leighton and the other leaders. But, of course, once Leighton came to know his men properly, people like Sir Oliver, Sir John, Mr. D.S. Senanayake, and so on, you see, he didn't bother very much about the governor coming into the picture at all, you see.
What was Caldicott's stand on independence in 45-46? When he went to London later, did he, for instance, as a past governor, support it?
Well, as it was supported by the commander-in-chief, I have no reason to doubt that he did not lend support to it, with possibly certain provisos, which he may have, through normal experience, have thought necessary, you see. But by and large, he gave all the necessary support for this independent constitution, which was originally mooted and supported by the commander-in-chief, Leighton.
Can you remember any of the battles with the ministers in early years? Friction between Caldicott directly, rather than, say, on the chief secretary's behalf?
No, I can't remember anything very special, except that there may have been quite a few rubs on the question of important appointments, which eventually had to be sanctioned by the three officers of state, and I believe by the governor. I'm not sure about that at that time. Mm-hmm. That was one of the items on which they may have disagreed widely. The other item, of course, on which they disagreed very widely were, of course, certain legislation passed by the House of, by what was called the State Council at the time, which the governor had the authority to refuse, you see, to not to sanction, not to approve on behalf of the Queen, you see. And that happened fairly often, I believe, particularly on matters dealing with financial subjects and possibly some legal matters, you see. But by and large, the normal legislation that any country enacts for purposes of good government were not, I believe, refused or rejected on.
Can you remember some incident when D.S. virtually resigned and he walked out, and whole cabinet also threatened to resign, and then I think the governor backed down?
I believe, though I'm not quite sure, it was either over the appointment or the dismissal of an Inspector General of Police. I think it was that.
Banks.
And the particular name of the person was either Banks or Halland. I don't know which one it was. But I think you are right in saying that. They said that unless their view was taken, which was a unanimous view of the cabinet, except of the three officers of state who also constituted the Board of Ministers, it was the unanimous decision of all the others, of these others.
Wasn't it over some hasty strike in which maybe the Inspector General was involved?
Now that, can you give me...
Mull lawyer and the question of prosecutions being... being deferred or something like that?
May very well be, mm-hmm. but I really couldn't say whether that was so or not.
I'm trying to think of the date. I think it was before you joined the minister, possibly. Yeah, you know, before you became
secretary to the Ministry of Minister of Agriculture, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It may very well be, but I do know that when banks or whoever it was left, they were left with a rather poor police force, and they wanted it revitalized. And they did get down four people who were supposed to be well versed in their particular subjects. Halland, I think, became Inspector General of Police. Bacon was another. Helen, Bacon, and the two others I forget. But the four of them did come and did sort of try to straighten things out. But eventually I think Mr. Senanayake lost confidence in a few of them, and eventually they left.
Why?
He lost confidence in them because they thought they were really not doing the job of work that he wanted them for, you see. Internal security, law and order were some of the main functions that the police were called upon to perform, which he thought they didn't perform satisfactorily.
Oh, it's a question of ability. I was wondering whether they were tended to be arrogant.
Well, on this question of arrogance, I would almost say that 50% of the foreigners did show that form of arrogance till they either came to know their minister well enough, you see, or till they realized that arrogance will not help them one jot, you see.
Mm-hmm. I was just going back to the question of the personnel who were important at that time and who might have had some influence on either the governor or the colonial secretary or the secretary of state. How about Drayton? How did he get on with the DS and the ministers?
Drayton, I got the general impression here that he was a very diplomatic sort of individual who got on reasonably well with the Board of Ministers, and I believe he himself was a bit of a lawyer, was he?
Yes, he was.
And he first came as legal secretary, then became chief secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he got on reasonably well with these people, and you'll see, smoothened out various little problems that arose. And that sort of thing.
In fact, Jennings is quite definite here. He says Drayton was much better than the previous ones and established some sort of rapport. But didn't DS and Drayton have one, a really big row at the end over some small issue perhaps? Having cooperated for quite some time.
Drayton and?
DS and Drayton.
Not that I can really think of, except I was wondering whether it may have been on a matter like the date of independence or some such thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't now at this stage recollect any major issue that involved these people.
And just a final question on those lines. How about Huxham and Nigel? How would you assess those two? And Moore?
Now, Sir Henry Moore, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Well, as you know, Sir Henry Moore himself was one of these old civil servants who joined the overseas civil service and eventually found his way into Ceylon. And as you know, it was during his period, during his regime as governor, that we had this interregnum, the period between, I believe, September 47 and February 48, before we eventually got independence. And he was the first man to be selected as Governor General of Ceylon, like what happened in India when Lord Mountbatten, who was the first Viceroy, became the first Governor General. You see, I mean, we possibly followed the pattern of India fairly closely on these matters. My own recollection of Sir Henry Moore was that he was not as capable a man as Sir
Andrew
Caldicott. But he got on reasonably well with everyone, and obviously for him to be selected as the first Governor General would give one the impression that, quite apart from the fact that that was a course of action that was almost normal, would also give one the impression that they really wanted him also, you see, to be the first Governor General because of the assistance he gave in the actual independence that the country gained eventually, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the latter is correct.
Did he give wholehearted support?
Well, you know, this question of asking whether a person gave wholehearted support is a rather difficult thing to answer.
Uh-huh.
But generally speaking, you see, once the colonial office had the idea that Ceylon should gain independence, that Ceylon had made a definite contribution to the war effort, and as I told you yesterday, had certain advantages over other Southeast Asian countries on the question of literacy and per capita income and health standards and all that sort of thing. When they realized that, and when they also found that they had, either due to political reasons or reasons of violence, bloodshed or whatever it was, had to give in to places like Burma and India and Pakistan, they saw no reason why a country which had so many advantages and had the biggest advantage of not having had any form of violence exercised for this special purpose, being given independence.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your impression regarding his attitude, Moore's?
Moore's attitude, I believe, was generally to, to accept the inevitable as it were, you see. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just, when independence came, he just took independence as it came. And there you are, it was, actually I was present on the day they signed the defense agreements. That was on the 27th of September, and then the interregnum period, and then the eventual independence on the 4th of February 48.
How about the relations between Huxham and Nigel and the ministers?
Well, Huxham, as you know, came to Ceylon first as income tax commissioner. He was the man who first introduced income tax to Ceylon and was the first income tax commissioner. He was, I believe, an inspector of tax in England or something like that. And he did introduce certain methods which organizing a department like that was not an easy thing. He did organize it reasonably well, and I think one must say that the success of the department today to a large extent is due to the initial organization. This man made to this department, his contribution. Then from there he became a financial secretary, which was almost a follow-up from his last job. And as financial secretary, you see, practically every financial secretary's job under the Donomo Constitution had been, you see, not so much to increase the public debt or to borrow or to do various things that would involve the country's future generations in loans and whatnot, but to make what use they could of the revenue they derived in any particular financial year, and also put in reserve a certain amount which they would be able to utilize later on. And that is why you found that during this period development really was, I should say, very little, you see. Most of the money, of course, normally even today, one could say that 60% of the revenue of any organization is utilized in payment of emoluments, you see, and the balance is used on various other things. So that 60% in the government sector, as far as revenue went, was utilized for that purpose. And the balance was utilized on various agricultural and other schemes. I'm not at all certain that if not for Mr. Senanayake, that they would have ever started any real big scheme like the Mineria scheme or the Kalavava scheme or the Yodhala scheme, or have any big model farms, you see, like the Mineria farm or places like that, or agricultural schools and so on. These were all his own personal efforts, you see, or in fact bring under cultivation so much land, you see, by the restoration of tanks and that sort of thing. So one must say that on the financial side, the financial secretary's job was really to see that he kept back as much money as possible, and one may almost say that he was one of those tight-fisted people who gave only when he just could not spare what could be given, you see. You just don't for a minute. What's your problem?
Yesterday we came up to the Solbury report examining the process, the movement towards independence.
Yes.
I know that Senanayake went to London before the report came out. You know, just I think he timed it so that he could go there and to ask for more than the in fact, I think he demanded full independence straight off.
Yes.
Did you go to London?
No, I didn't go to London on that occasion. Mm-hmm. The man who went to London on that occasion was Arthur Ranasinghe, you see. And the excuse given, of course, was, I think if I did press, Senanayake might have taken me. He said that the acting minister would require my services and that it would be unfair for him to take me along. Instead of me, he took Dr. D.M.D. Silva, who's now in retirement, I believe in Kandy or somewhere. he's written some book or the other, I find recently, who had, as his sort of social secretary, you see, but there was really no special problem that he was involved with.
Have you any idea from second-hand knowledge why the British government of that time, a new Labour government, turned this request down? Because the Solbright Commission gave virtual independence, they just wanted the last few restrictions knocked off. But they turned it down in late 45, early 46, I think. But a few years later they agreed, 1 year later in fact.
That I really couldn't tell you, you see. It may be for one reason that they did not want to change as soon as the new Labour government came, possibly the report was submitted, and they did not want, without further examination, to change what the previous government, which had been in existence for some time, had agreed upon. You see, that may be one of the reasons. You see?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see. And do you know if...
And one of the other reasons I could possibly think of was, of course, that we had gone through a period of war and so on. And you see, I mean, this is only a surmise, that if Britain itself was looking for whatever they could get from their colonies, and if they gave up at that stage, well, whatever they reaped from Ceylon in the way of financial gains would have been zero. I mean, that's merely a surmise, but that is a possibility, you see.
And of course then came the final stage in 47-48. Can you recall anything of particular importance in that?
Well, I can't think of anything very important except that this, one of the things was an agreement that had to be signed relating to public officers and the defense of the country, which was signed, which I believe is in print somewhere, that I was present at the time that was signed at midnight on a certain date, the date being the 27th of September 1965. I got a photograph of that really with me. And
47.
Mm-hmm. And in 48, of course, it took a little time to reorganize the various departments and allocation of subjects and functions. The administration for the purposes of the changeover, which was undertaken by Sir Charles Collins, you see, at that time. Hello?
Yes.
What were we on now?
47, the defense agreements, and you felt that was one of the things you witnessed.
Yes, yes, yes. The defense agreement and the agreement relating to the foreign public officers, how they were eventually going to be dealt with, you see. Retirement with compensation and that sort of thing, you see, which they were rather keen on.
Did DS have any doubts or reservations about signing this?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of these men who told me, and he told so many others, our object should be this. Whenever something is given, consider it carefully. If it is an advantage to our advantage, take it and ask for more. You see? Don't say no and ask for the moon. You ask for something, they strike somewhere midway, well, take it. And the moment you take it, well, go on asking for more. And that's precisely what he did.
We were talking about his advisors yesterday, and it suddenly struck me last night that we hadn't discussed D.R. Vijayawardena's role.
D.R. Vijayawardena was one of his biggest advisors on the publicity side. As you know, he was the owner of the Lake House Group. And they were, I mean, quite apart from the fact that he was the managing director of that press, he was also a very great personal friend of the family. And I believe there was never a day they didn't meet. You see, what they discussed and all that sort of thing, no one really knows.
Mm-hmm.
but they must have discussed a wide range of subjects dealing from politics to,
usually a trio, OEG,
DR. No, I don't think it was generally a trio. A trio or even four, five, six, seven maybe on certain occasions. But the two of them were great personal friends, and they did discuss among themselves quite a number of things. And D.R. Vijayawardhani himself, as you know, was a very intelligent man. He was a Cambridge man, I believe, you see, and he was able to interpret what he said and put down in an editorial or in any news item exactly what he wanted, you see, or what the country should have, or in various ways do what he wanted.
I'm not saying this in a detrimental sense, but I presume he could also publicize DSN Nayaka and ultimately the UNP too, and their achievements.
Well, as I was telling someone only the other day, the press has reached a stage now where they can make and break a government. Isn't that so? I mean, in the sense that, well, you can go on building them up, not in the wrong sense, you can always say, well, they are now importing, instead of 100,000 tons of fertilizers, 250,000 tons, which they are importing better planting material, this, that, we are getting more agricultural implements under aid schemes, various other schemes. It's true we are giving a measure of rice free, but still we are earning, say, 10 cents on each measure. And it's not only that, we are probably saving a lot on foreign exchange, and a large portion of it is being used back again, sort of being plowed into the field business in various ways, you see, fertilizer, agricultural implements, some better planting material, this, that, and all that. And they can build you up well that way. So, industrially, they can say, well, we started with only one industry. The first we ever had was only cement. Well, today we have 296 industries, you see, some of which like cigarettes, chocolates, tobacco, you see, cement of international standard or whatever it is, you see. I mean, there are various ways of building up people and the country if they really want to, you see. I mean, you can always say, well, we are going to have so many industrial schools, which are junior universities. We are going to have three more universities. We are going to increase our numbers. The people we want are not people at the very top level or very low level, but people at the middle level, which is in fact the correct thing. And therefore, we are going to have not five technical schools, but 25. And we are going to build this up this way, that way, and do various things, you see. A paper can always build you in any way possible. Mm-hmm.
Regarding the final grant of independence and success, DSS success in getting the British to give this ahead of time,
yes.
Someone put forward a theory that because in this time there were some serious strikes, 46-47, both DS and Oliver argued, among other arguments, they told the British, let us deal with the Marxists. Why do you want to bear that burden and that problem? Let us shoulder the burden.
Frankly, I couldn't help you on that, you see. I mean, you may have read this in some of Jennings' books.
No,
this
is not Jennings. This is a private view.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help you on that, because even if they said that, that must have been an absolute confidence across the table, as it were, and something that is possibly not known, you see.
Another, I'm trying this as a long shot, but there's another story that they had dropped a broad hint to Solbury when he came here, that if Ceylon got independence, he would be the first Governor General.
I can't give you any first-hand information of this.
Naturally.
But logically, I think that's one of the things I would have said myself. If I may say so, you see, I mean, you come as the chairman of a body that is appointed to see whether the country is fit for independence. And you say, well, go around, have a look. Well, this is what we want. This is our draft. Well, these get the views of the various minorities. Find out what you think. If you think we are fit for independence, well, you will probably be the best to work it. I mean, it's perfectly logical to say that.
Mm-hmm. How did you find Sowerbury as a man?
He was a wonderful man to work with. In every way, you see, I mean,
courteous,
he is very courteous, very educated, he not irrelevant in any way, you see, always to the point. Even in a discussion he had with you, you found him extremely courteous. And as a matter of fact, you'll be interested to know that since he left in 54, I still carry on correspondence with him. When I was with in London last year, I went to see him about May last year. He was quite ill, and he was in the private wing of the University College Hospital, and I was there with him for about an hour, you see. I went with my wife, and we were talking to him for nearly an hour there. And I really felt that if we were selecting a man, a foreigner, you see, to be our first Governor General. Of course, the interregnum, and I'm not talking of the interregnum and the Sir Henry Moore, but subsequently, I don't think we could have had a better choice.
Was there a rather schoolmasterish in attitude? I mean, and a bit stiff, you know, perhaps, you know, because of his conservatism?
I don't think so. I doubt that very much. You see, because when he came and stayed here for quite a few months, working on his report, he came to know not only the people but the country, as well as the people that mattered extremely well, you see. And it was very unlikely that when he returned as Governor General, at the request of these same leaders, that he would have been shown any form of stiffness to them. But I can tell you this, that I went to Queen's House. I was the first Ceylonese official secretary to the Governor General after, say, I don't know, 165 years or something, if you take the Portuguese, Dutch and British period all together. I found him extremely good, and he showed me absolutely no difference from his two other secretaries, the private secretary and the military secretary, the ADC, you see, and I got on extremely well with him.
Yes, I asked that question because I was wondering why he didn't like Sir John, or at least so it appears.
Well, I am not too sure about his likes and dislikes, you see, but certainly he liked old D.S. very much. I don't think he had anything against Sir John, except possibly, you see, the fact that Sir John, in his, don't you know, in his usual exuberance, may have said, I say, we must now have a Ceylonese Governor General business. Don't you know, he's always that, as he told me one day, he told me, I always talk, then think. You see, so that's the sort of reason. But I have no special reason to believe that he was antagonistic towards him or anything like that, really.
I was wondering whether you knew anything of the Premier Stakes, as it was called, after D.S.'s rather unfortunate accident.
Well, I did know something about it. You see, I mean, I wouldn't like to give you the name of the author, though I am fairly confident I am right.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that was a very bad piece of work, because constitutionally, the selection of a prime minister lies mainly in the hands of the Governor General, after due consultation with the other leading members of the cabinet, you see. And if after consultation with the others they thought that Mr. X was better than Mr. Y, or Mr. X should take be the next, well, I mean, I don't think you could blame a Governor General for that, you see, because personally I think that is one of the major responsibilities of a Governor General, and he must exercise it with great care and thought. And in doing so, even if he does make a mistake, I don't think one should attach any malice towards it, you see. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I want you to bear in mind in all my discussions with you, that these are sort of completely off the record, as you know. Mm-hmm. I just speak as you fire the question,
as you think.
And as I think, you mm-hmm. see, so that
considered written.
I don't write and then rewrite and then think, no, I think we better remove this word and that sort of thing. So you must bear all that in mind, whatever you transcribe to your mm-hmm. documents.
No, I'm not thinking merely of the question of the Premier's takes, the publication, but when D.S. died and the question of his succession rose, and Alan Rose was here.
Yes.
Now, for instance, isn't it correct to say that there was a small group within the UNP
yes.
which developed and wanted Dudley appointed?
Well, I mean, I would have thought that there may have been a group that wanted Dudley, there may have been a group that wanted Sir John, and possibly there may have been even a third and a fourth group who may have wanted another Mr. X or Mr. Y, you see. But that is precisely the reason why all leaders are consulted. All leading people, all leading members of the cabinet are consulted, and the Governor General arrives at a decision.
Did he consult leading members on that occasion?
Well, I can't tell you officially whether he did or not, you see, but I have no reason to doubt that he did not follow the general practice.
I was wondering whether as private secretary he asked you to summon...
No, he didn't do that. But I do know that when I was with Sir Oliver, he did ask me to do precisely what you did, you see. Not as private secretary, as secretary, you see. Private secretary,
yes,
generally some relative or daughter or someone. You see, but as secretary he did ask me, well, get an M. Pereira, get Shelvanayagam, get Dr. Vikramasinghe, get so-and-so, so-and-so, when Mr. Bandaranaike was assassinated. And then he had discussions with all of them, and he did that.
Solbury did that?
Well, not
through you?
Not through me, definitely.
But OET did that through you?
Because as a matter of fact, I was not with Solbury at that time. At the time D.S. died, I was not with Solbury. You see, the man he had at that time was an Englishman.
Oh, I see.
Mulhall.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so whether Mulhall did that, I couldn't say. You see, but when I was secretary to the Governor General, I came at a time when Hingley left. Actually, that was only about 3 or 4 months before Solbury himself left.
And that was in Sir John's time?
No, this was the time when this happened. This happened when Mr. Dudley Senayake became Prime Minister for 3 months and lost on the throne speech, you see, and they had to... I'm mixing up something or the other now. So let me tell you. Yes. No, I'll tell you. When Mrs. Bandaranayake?
No, not that time. I'm now beginning to get a little confused.
No, it would have been 53 when you became additional secretary to the Governor General
Paramahansa. At some time or the other, I do remember his consulting all these various parties, party leaders, you see. It may have been the time when Mr. Dudley Senanayake came with a bare majority. Mm-hmm. You see, for the second time. I think it may have been about that time.
Just a few questions on the pre-48 period and the Board of Ministers when you were private secretary to the Senanayake before independence.
Before independence, they had no one called a private secretary, you see.
Oh.
Before independence, everyone was called secretary to the Minister of Agriculture or secretary to the Minister of Labour or secretary to the Minister of Finance or whatever it was, you see. There was this business of...